Welcome back to the Rate It Change with York Wealth Management. As advisors to some of the wealthiest families in the country, the Rate It Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. I'm your host, Murdoch Gaddy, and today's Rockcast, we sit down with Nick Thompson, executive at Equasia at their offices, to explore the world of private credit and structured finance. If you're interested in how private credit funds are structured, how lending is approached outside of traditional banks, or you're simply looking for a means of potentially getting equity-style returns without taking equity risk, then I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Nick. Nick's been in the industry for, like over 25 years, worked for majors such as UBS, JP Morgan, AMP, I think even an international bank as well. His perspective is great, offers a unique look into how capital flows, deal structuring, investment access has evolved over the past two decades. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Nick also gets into detail about one of the funds that I'm mainly interested in, which is the Equasia Private Investment Fund. It's a wholesale fund that lends across sectors like real estate development, social infrastructure projects like disability accommodation and childcare, businesses, other logistics facilities. The other interesting thing about how they approach it is rather than looking at equity-style risk, the fund focuses on senior secured loans, mezz finance, convertible notes, which essentially offers investors access to these investments with a strong emphasis on capital protection via asset-backed lending. As of time of recording about 2 months ago, the numbers, I think their past performance up until December last year was averaging roughly about 14%. Nick will get into that. Based on most recent data as of March 2025, the Equasia Private Investment Fund has produced a one-year return of 10.38% based on their website, and since inception, annualized return of 10.05% net of fees, targeting a 10% return per annum. Throughout the discussion with Nick, he shares valuable insights into what's driving private credit markets currently, the increased internationalization of capital, and private lending has evolved to become a mainstream allocation for many wealthy families' portfolios. So before we get into the conversation, please remember this Rockcast is made for entertainment purposes only. It's important to remember that past performance is not a reliable indicator of future returns, and today's conversation is designed to help you learn more about the nature of private credit investing rather than particular advice. I encourage you to listen to the disclaimer at the end of this podcast and to keep your feedback coming. This is not personal advice at all. In saying that, if you have any questions about the guests that we have on, if there's any funds or fund manager, or asset manager, or strategies that you've heard about from a friend, a colleague, an advisor that you want to do a deeper dive into, and not just the information memorandums or the information packets they send out, please send them my way, or give me a call, or reach out to me on email, and we can get into it together. I love learning about new strategies. So, with that being said, you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Nick. I really did. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Nick Thompson, welcome to the Rate of Change with York Wealth Management.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to be here. Nick, many people know who you are in this wild world of finance, but some people may not be familiar with yourself. So why don't we tell everyone a little bit about yourself and how you're going to finance?
A little bit about myself, yeah. I'm lucky enough to have three kids. I've been in finance for quite some time now, probably longer than I care to put a number to. I've been here at Equasia for about 9 years. Before that, I was on the investment banking side at a few places. I was at UBS, JP Morgan, and a small Malaysian bank, and I came across here to join some old colleagues who started Equasia. Before that, many, many moons ago, I started out life at AMP. I worked on their listed property trusts, which got taken over in the sort of early 2000s, which was interesting sort of introduction to your corporate career. But so I've done a few things. So all up, probably best part of 25 years or so in various forms of either property funds management or broader funds management and investment banking.
What's the biggest change that you've seen?
Biggest change I've seen is look, in a way, the circle sort of, you know, continues. So there's new ideas or repackaged ideas. Things move quicker nowadays. There's more access to pockets of capital. There's more international investors in things than there was in the past. And I think, you know, the other thing is there's more sort of investment opportunities for the average punter out there in terms of be it either wholesale or sophisticated. You know, you can get way more exposure to things like international equities or private deals, private equity, private credit than, you know, sort of 20, 25 years ago, most people were invested in equities because that's basically all there was for that they could get access to. So I think there's a broader range for people. It's more interesting. People are more in tune with it as well. Superannuation, you know, is well entrenched in our society in terms of people managing that for their own retirement. They're empowered by that versus, you know, if you look back to your parents' generation, they didn't have super. They weren't worried about where the markets were going.
They could also purchase a house for potentially
that they could.
For what was it, two or three times the income? I think what's the average now? This is 11. Has it gone to 12 yet?
It's probably.
And it's two incomes now. It's not one.
It is a two-person game buying a house in Sydney. So yes.
Sorry, it's actually become three-person. It's you two plus your parents.
Plus the
bank. Or the grandparents, the bank of mum and dad.
Or we do. We'll get onto the portfolio, but we do quite a bit of lending to properties, to residential. And yeah, there's lots of three-generation households where, you know, there's grandparents or somebody who were part of that, effectively part of the household. So yeah, that's that, you know, the rise of property prices is changing some demographics. It's changing how people live in terms of apartment accommodation and the like versus, you know, the sort of traditional Australian dream of owning a quarter acre block. But the flip side for people is if you can get in on the property ladder, and it's a way for, you know, people to create wealth and then invest that wealth for their own retirement or leisure and travel and that sort of stuff. So it's, you know, we're always reasonably optimistic about the future here at Equasia, even though things are expensive.
Yeah, leisure and travel. All right, so we just came back from holidays and you kind of, half your brain's there, half your brain's back here, but a lot of fun. No, we're joking off air saying, I think from what I took from that is the biggest change has probably been the access to assets and then the access to capital, and it's kind of like just all ramping up and evolving. And I think we've been joking on lines to discuss it like fantasy football. Now it's essentially become fantasy football with asset managers. You know, it's like take your pick. Everything's becoming faster, more accessible. You know, what do you want to do? And then finding who's the best that operates, and then make your own team, right?
Yep, pick your own team, and you can put together you know, a wide variety of asset classes that if you want to invest in, you know, from international equities through to local private credit, private equity, people, you know, effectively can get access to now if you're a wholesale investor, as opposed to, you know, you don't have to be an institution or somebody operating out of New York to get exposure to a Blackstone or a KKR or somebody like that. So there's a wide range of choice for people. And, you know, that has resulted in opportunities for advisors to help people navigate that way through. It's a very different investment opportunity and opportunity set than just having an equities portfolio and maybe an investment property. That, you know, nowadays is yielding you probably 1.5% or 2% by the time you take out all the costs. You know, I think that's an empowerment of people, and that's reflective of not just in investments, you know. Things like social media, things like being able to do things over the internet, make people more empowered. They can. I was away recently overseas, and
Where were you overseas?
I was in the US, and I was trying to buy something for my wife. And I rang her, and she, whilst I was at the store, she was on the store website saying, "No, that's what I want." Like that's amazing, as opposed to not that long ago, you know, you would have been sort of you would have been there yourself without being able to sort of have that contact. So people are more empowered in a way. It's more democratic, that it's not just some special opportunities for insiders or the wealthy. People can get access to pretty much whatever they like.
And so fast as well. I remember when I first traveled, like first hit Europe when I was like 19, if you needed to do any form of communication, you were just completely cut off until you ended up at a you know, a cafe, a random cafe. And you're like, you're spending 10 euro for like an hour. And you're like, oh my God, I've got like 38, like you're 300 emails to go through. I haven't looked at this in 21 days. People are like, are you alive?
Are you alive? What's happened to you? Yeah, whereas now that's probably in a way a bit of the downside of it. You're available 24/7.
It's just FaceTime. It's like, darling, what are you looking at? You sure you're buying the right one? Okay, look, correct. Put me on video.
Yes.
Turn the camera. Not that one. I want the other one.
But at least you get it right.
At least you get it right.
That is a positive driving force across, you know, multiple things in multiple industries. So, and investments and financial services are no different.
Absolutely. Now, before we get into finance, which we'll wax lyrical about, you're into fantasy as well. See, I'm a Premier League diehard. Can't help myself. It's just the generation we're brought up with. What's your poison?
My poison's AFL fantasy. I probably spend a bit much time, according to my family, doing that. But can be a bit addictive, and it's not wildly different from a financial services portfolio, really.
It really isn't, is it? You're essentially picking players in your team.
In your team, and you only got so much money to spend.
It's awesome. It's a lot of fun.
I'll spend a bit of time to it. Not too much.
Who's your picks for this year?
It would be interesting to see.
Season's about to ramp up.
So you got to wait to see who's injured and who's not. Right? So I haven't spent that much time as yet. So we'll see when it all gets a bit closer.
So if anyone's wondering why we're waxing lyrical about fantasy, is I was joking before. I wasn't really joking. I was just saying my approach to all of this is it's practically fantasy football with fund managers these days, you know, which goes back to the whole access and everything like that. It's a great time which we live in. So back to Aquasia, why don't we just give everyone a bit of color around exactly, you know, what the house does, you know, what funds are available, like what's the investment philosophy, what do you do?
Yeah, sort of the 30-second, 1 minute on us, probably start at the start, which is usually the best place to begin. So 15 years ago, we were established. Our two principal partners, there's about 20 of us, we're all owners of the firm in various components. Our two principal partners founded Aquasia. They were running the Australian operations of the Dutch investment bank, ABN AMRO. They left there, started Aquasia. We basically do two things within Aquasia. Corporate advisory, which is what we sort of were originally first set up for. So there we do M&A and IPO advice. Over the years, our clients have been people like News Corporation, Transurban, IPH, the patent attorney business. So that business continues on and is a great business, and we've got great clients. Our first funds that we did were probably about 13 or 14 years ago. So as well as the corporate advisor, which was sort of its own separate business, we can tap into some of the resources there when we need it. We have about $1.3, $1.4 billion of funds under management in credit funds. So we did a couple of credit funds coming out of the sort of wreckage of the GFC, where there was a couple of credit funds that had failed, and we took them over and managed those out and made some really good returns for our investors. Out of that, we started our enhanced credit fund, which has been going for about 13 years. That is a fund that targets sort of cash plus three. We have a short-term liquidity fund, which is sort of cash plus one and a half. And then I run our private investment fund, where our target return is 10% after fees to investors. We're coming up on about 7 years of running that, and just rough size-wise, we're about $550 million. So all of our funds management is focused on credit. The vast majority of our credit investments are asset-heavy. So the Enhanced Credit Fund invests in a lot of mortgages and asset-backed loans for things like auto warehouses. And then on the private investment side, we invest in emerging companies and real estate, but with a sort of bias towards hard asset backing. So usually first ranking mortgages over either a piece of property or a company. Those companies, we usually like them to have some sort of asset, so we don't sort of do cash flow or people business type lens. We want some hard assets there.
So the origins of it, the credit side, wasn't because
the origins come really from the people. So one of our partners ran all the markets business at ABN AMRO, and before that at Citigroup in Australia and offshore. So it's sort of the heritage of the people. And my colleague who's been managing the Enhanced Credit Fund for 13 years, he's been managing it the whole time. He was a credit trader and credit derivatives trader.
So what my question is, because normally what happens, what I've found is this, like, I normally hear from a lot of, you know, other competitors, right? You know, they've seen essentially what happened in the GFC, and then essentially an opportunity was created, right? They didn't want to deal with it anymore, so you needed a middleman, and then essentially you go get a $100 million bank, you know, facility from the bank, and then you're essentially middlemaning the transaction, which makes a lot of sense. But did you just say that how you got into the credit is because you ended up with a deal?
So
how did that happen?
So there was this predated my time, but there was a receiver auction of some failed credit funds. We put together a small syndicate of family and friends and high net worths. Bought that credit fund, managed it out. I think the returns on that were about a 30% IRR. It was sort of 2010, so it was coming, you know, late 2010, coming out of the wreckage of the GFC. Those investors then went into a second fund, and from there we started an open-ended fund. So that's probably, you know, something in terms of our funds that may be a little bit different from some other people around town is we don't have any leverage in our fund. So all of our $1.3 billion is investors' money. So there's no leverage overlay or anything on that. And we sort of haven't been traditional brokers of deals. We've always been an investor where we've raised money and then invested on behalf of investors. So that was sort of the origin. And in a sort of strange way, each of the funds has almost sort of grown out of one or the other. So our Enhanced Credit Fund was doing quite well. It was seeing individual standalone deals that they liked the deals, but they weren't permitted under its mandate. So from that, we started the private investment fund. Our first close was about $10 or $15 million. So from that, we've grown over that period. So we sort of take our time when we seed something, but it's reacting to opportunities in the market and trying to marry up the capital with the opportunities. All of our funds, and I'm sure all the people you speak to on the private credit side, is the same. You know, it's partly driven by the same thing, which are the banking regulations, which mean banks do less and less commercial style lending. I'd sort of broadly put it, and they're encouraged by their capital charges to do more mortgages. So that has provided us with scope and clients who are looking for funding solutions. And there's a reasonable opportunity set which has continued to grow. So
it's just been a natural evolution.
It's just been a natural evolution, and you sort of tap into those opportunities as they come along. The good thing for us is, I think, as I touched on, we're staff owned. So, you know, we have things like independent investment committee members and the like, but we don't report into some corporate in Hong Kong or Zurich or New York or something. So, you know, we manage the business ourselves. So that gives you some flexibility to be able to grow and start things and seed them, and not be sort of panicked or in a blind rush to complete things. So we've just grown very organically and hopefully grown with our investors.
What's the expression? Show me how someone's remunerated, and I'll show you how they behave.
Yeah. No, I think that, well, you know, we've got a pretty simple structure here. We charge a management fee on our, putting aside the corporate advisory stuff, which is pretty standard. We charge a management fee, and you know, as we're owners of the business, we're incentivized to all work together. So, it maybe avoids some of the nuances or difficulties if people, you know, are on commission and things like that. It's sort of not catch and kill your own, which sometimes doesn't engender the greatest sort of collaborative working environment. So, and the good thing is, almost all of us work together somewhere else before Aquasia, so we've all known each other for a long time. So that's a good opportunity to be able to continue those relationships. So we're not, you know, some of my colleagues have been here since the start. They've been here 15 years. It builds an environment where you work together and you hopefully grow together.
So the fund which you personally oversee is the Aquasia Private Investment Fund, right? So why don't we just dig into the mechanics? So you've covered a little bit, but what exactly does it do? Why don't we start with what's the performance been, right?
Yeah, no, so I'll give you a rundown on what we do and performance. So last 12 months to December, we did, after our fees to investors, we did about 14.6% return, which is good, which is very healthy and we're very pleased with. So we provide usually first ranking. So, for example, at the moment, we've only got 1% of the book in senior, but we provide loans to across four portfolio components. So one is real estate, which has always been the biggest component of the portfolio. That's about 70%. I'll come back to that in detail. Emerging companies, so that's where as a business, you know, we have a first ranking mortgage. We help, you know, founders or investors or companies grow or, you know, take on an acquisition. Hopefully they grow and then we get refinanced out by a bank or a sale. And we can do two other components. One, opportunistic credit, is sometimes there's some, you know, mispriced securities out there or some bridge financing, for example. And we can do convertible notes. Over the years, we've only done one or two of those. So they're the four components of the portfolio that we invest in. A good chunk of our book is related to real estate. Our typical real estate loan is a sort of 18-month to 24-month loan at a loan-to-value ratio of about 60 to 65%. So we fund things like land subdivisions where we will have a borrower who has, say, sold 25 or 30% of the lots in pre-sales to end mum and dads. We help them settle the land and help fund putting in the services, so roads, sewer, power, electricity. We don't fund the end housing construction, the home building. The end mum and dad purchaser who's paid a 10% deposit, when we deliver, or a borrower delivers a clear block of land, they call the deposit. The deposit's already been paid. They call for settlement. They settle the land. Then the mum and dad engages with a home building company to build their 4 or 5 bedroom house. So a lot of that is in the suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. We like those markets. Housing is expensive, but the supply is very hard with you know, infrastructure, councils and government red tape. And there has been, over the last few years in particular, post-COVID, there's been very healthy levels of migration, which has sort of forced up, you know, demand for housing either via rental or for home purchases. So we've done quite a bit of that in the portfolio. We've done over the years a little bit of construction for apartments. We've got about two or three apartment projects left. We've really focused on one
mixed
area.
Mixed use or just apartments?
Mainly just apartments, often a little bit of retail downstairs, but most of our apartment stuff that we've done is not sort of the 10 or 15 level apartment, sort of two bedroom apartments. We sort of have tapped into a bit of a niche in terms of the downsizer market. So three or four levels, for example.
They're going for so much money.
We've had some in Rose Bay. We've had them in Brighton, in Melbourne.
Townhouses are going for like $3 million.
And look, the construction market has been very difficult because in terms of supply of materials post COVID, then supply of labour, construction costs are up a lot. That market we like. People are selling their family home. They're making a lifestyle decision, and they want a really nice three, sometimes four bedroom apartment. You know, enough room for the grandkids. They're not as sensitive to if interest rates go up or down 25 basis points because they've made a decision where, you know, they're moving there for the next stage of their life. So we've been able to tap into that for a bit. We've done a few of those, probably a bit less so at the moment. We've sort of been able to steer clear or navigate our way from, you know, we haven't done the sort of three tower, 500 apartments. That's not where we can compete.
No, I really like the space. I was chatting to another mate who's a developer, a real estate agent. He was chatting to his mates that knows a bunch of developers. And to give it a rough number, say 30 of them, which he knows, you know, say North Shore, out of the 30, 10 or 11 or 12 of them have actually turned their attention to exactly this particular market you're discussing. And what they're looking at predominantly is getting large blocks, putting townhouses on them so they still have access to essentially what the family can come and entertain in the back. Right, but these things are going for like $3 million. And the profit margin in comparison, so someone's downsizing, say, you know, where I grew up, Rosal, Chatswood, you know, where you live, Linfield, and then they're relocating to these lovely places that are half the size. But as you mentioned, they've got the cash and they're happy to pay for it.
They're happy to pay for it. They help fund their retirement, so they take some cash off the table. But and also they, you know, invariably close to feel like it's where they live, right? They don't necessarily want to move away. You know, a funny one that was over the years, we funded one on the Gold Coast, which was whole floor apartments, which if you said to us just top down, this is probably a bit reflective of sort of our philosophies. If you said top down, you want to fund apartments on the Gold Coast, we're like, that's not for us. But this was a sort of project that was a bit specific. They were right on the beach. We went through, you know, all the pre-sales contracts. We actually knew some of the purchasers that were, you know, executives in listed companies. And so that was one we funded, and we got a really great return. We got about 14.5% return from a senior loan. And so, you know, there's different drivers for different markets. And for us, we're a nice size fund. We would always like to get bigger, but you know, there's some broadly competitors of ours who've got, you know, $8, $10, $20 billion portfolios. We don't have that size of portfolio, so we can be not only selective but pretty, you know, sort of nimble and target the things that we like because we haven't got a mountain of money that we have to redeploy all the time. These opportunities come along. We like those opportunities. We've done a bit. We've done quite a bit in industrial over the years. We've involved in a syndicate for a land purchase of a very large parcel of land out near the new airport, where our borrower ended up selling that to a super fund. It was a really good deal. We liked the drivers of industrial. You know, work from home or Amazon style delivery.
When you say industrial, what type of industrial?
So this was land that was going to be developed into, you know, it was a very large parcel of land. All that was 300 hectares. Part of that will over time will be developed into data centers, which are, you know, incredibly large and getting larger, and general distribution. So more and more of our goods are getting delivered to us. They have to be taken off a ship or a plane, broken down into smaller components, and then shipped to you.
That's my holy grail of industrial. Essentially, those what do you call them? The distribution warehouses.
Distribution warehouses.
So the two that I see that are phenomenal, you know, correct if I'm wrong, is distribution warehouses and light industrial. The capacity for essentially some, like my family is up in Noosa, right? So it's always a running joke. You can't get a job in Noosa, but you can bring one. So now from the M1 all the way up, practically Crestmead, Ipswich, Jesus, you name it, these light industrial things are popping up everywhere. They're going for what, 550 grand to about 750, 800,000. You got yourself a walk up, two roller doors either side. You know, I could have my practice there. You could have someone making surfboards. You could have a dude selling Pokemon cards. It's a relevant, but they're phenomenal. And they're flying off the shelves, and the land's coming difficult to find now.
So you've got drivers like that, and then you've got things at the bigger end in terms of larger distribution centers for the Woolies and Coles and those people.
Amazons
who have, you know, they have very large space requirements. You know, this is sort of, we've been refinanced out of that loan, but, you know, the people who are going to be the end users there were the likes of the DHLs and Amazons of the world. And then you've got data centers, which are relatively, in a way, relatively new. They are big space users, big energy users, and they want to be well located in terms of access to transport or in particular power. The margins on their business, have seen things like AirTrunk have been sold for multiple billions of dollars. Them buying the land to be able to establish a new center is helping drive up the price as well, because they need the space. And they're sort of building capacity for things like, you know, when AI continues to grow, they're going to be very big users of space. So we try and sort of tap into some things like that. And underlying, if we lend at a reasonable loan to value ratio of, you know, 60% to 65%, that gives you a bit of headroom, because if you're involved in a component where our borrower is doing some development, you know, we do a lot of work with them. They have timelines, they have plans. Things don't always go exactly to time. They either take longer or there's twists and turns. So you've got a bit of a headroom there to protect yourself. But so far, so good. You know, we've done in our fund, which is now $550 million roughly of investors' money, over the 7 years, we have invested in about $1.4 billion of loans that have either been repaid or the loans in the portfolio now. So all up, we've done about 81, 82 loans that have been cycled through the fund.
What's the size of the loans?
Typical size for us is sort of about that $20 to $40 million. That, you know, that's a bit of a sweet spot for us given our size. If it's a loan that's under $5 million, that's often done by sort of family and friends or, you know, sort of people's individual networks. If it's a big loan that's over $100, $150 million, you often bump into bigger credit funds, banks, some hedge funds. So for us, we like that size rise. Now, we have done bigger and smaller, but that's sort of our target market is around that.
So with the mechanics, is it purely the money which you're using from the fund from investors, or do you have a bank warehouse facility sitting in the back?
We have no bank warehouse facility. We have no leverage, so it's just investors' money. So we think that gives us extra control in terms of there's no leverage or bank provider that we have to comply covenants with. If there is a loan that gets repaid, that money gets repaid to our investors. The return goes to our investors. We're not paying interest to some other provider.
Just a simple question, just for my benefit. I think I know the answer, but maybe people aren't familiar with this. If you've got a bank warehouse facilities in the back compared to how you're running things, and you say that essentially it's like first mortgage, you know, your first one on it. If with the warehouse facility, does that mean that essentially, you know, if everything goes sideways, the bank can essentially put the fund manager under in order to take the assets? Does that make sense?
Well, it probably depends in detail on
how it's structured.
How it's structured. Yeah. But put it this way, if you've got, just I'll talk for us, and you know, so if you've got a $100 loan, we've invested $100 in it. If you've got a $100 loan and you've got a sort of a warehouse facility, maybe they've put the first 40 in and you've put 60 in.
Yeah.
So extreme example, you know, if things go badly and we have to sell the property or the company and we get $60 back, we would give that $60 to our investors. And they would have incurred a bit of a loss. If you get in the same example, you get the $60 back. Well, the credit provider who's given you 40, they get all their money back.
They get all their money back. And then essentially the investors are screwed. And then essentially the fund, funds in trouble as well.
Is in a bit of trouble. So that's
that's how I thought it was. I was just double checking.
Short term, that debt probably at a lower cost, so it can enhance your returns. But there is a price to be paid for that. And, you know, thankfully this is not a visual medium, but as you can see, I've got a bit of grey hair. We've all got a bit of grey hair around here. So, you know, the leverage in, we don't use any leverage, and that's not something that we've sort of ever used. You know, we have over the years been in second ranking or mezzanine positions where we've gone, you know, behind a bank or another credit fund, or sometimes, you know, you've had a blend between a senior position and a mezzanine position to enhance your returns. So we do that, but there's no leverage within our funds. So, you know, we control our destiny for our investors, and we answer to our investors, not to some credit provider or warehouse provider as well.
One actually thing before I forget, on how the performance has worked out, because I had a client on the phone with you guys as well, just to discussing how this works. So if you look at the performance on the monthlies, it's paying, say, 1% as an average, right? But then you've done 14. So we were discussing it off air. Where does the extra couple of points come from?
So the way our funds are structured, in not every loan, but in most loans, our borrowers pay an interest rate, they might pay a line fee, and they pay what is known as an upfront fee for, you know, the deal sort of coming together. There are different models for different private credit funds, but where we are able to negotiate an upfront fee or the like from our borrowers, if that gets paid, that money, some managers take some of that for the work that they've done. We put the upfront fee back into the return for investors. In some cases, we are able to charge exit fees or penalties or some default interest. All of that goes into the return as well. There are different models where some of that will go to the manager. So, you know, in our 14.6%, we had probably 1.5 to 2% of that return was from some upfront fees. We had a couple of quirky things that happened over the course of 2024. We were in a reasonable, quite a big loan for the portfolio. It had two pieces of security. They sold one of that. We rolled our debt against the other piece of land. We were able to negotiate quite a healthy upfront that enhanced the return. The other thing was, our money was not repaid to us and then had to be reinvested. It was stayed invested the whole time. We had another one where we had an opportunistic credit deal, which was a borrower who has been a borrower of mine and also the enhanced credit fund. We know them well. They were sort of after some, broadly speaking, some bridge financing. We were able to negotiate quite a nice upfront. That was for a 7-month loan that effectively got for our investors about a 19% internal rate of return. They don't come along every day, those opportunities. So there's a sort of couple of quirky things in there in terms of upfront fees and a little bit of extension fees, but that's what goes into the returns. So on a monthly basis, the in-place stuff in the portfolio does about 1 to 1.1. Our return was enhanced by some of those upfront fees. So we had a few months where we did 120 basis points or 145 that enhanced the return.
That's important to go through because when I was looking at the numbers, you know, for historically, not to toot your horn, but you're doing bloody well. I think you're currently top of the charts. You know, if we're talking about a music reference, you're top of the charts. But I was trying to work out, where does the extra points come from? But essentially what you're saying is you're passing on.
We're passing on those upfront fees that the borrowers pay or any extension fees and line fees and the like that goes into the return for investors. So we've to be clear, we have a target rate of return of 10% for investors. So in the almost 7 years since inception, we've been about 10.4%. So that's after the management fees, and our management fee structure is pretty straightforward. We have a base management fee of 1%, and then we get 20% of our performance over the 10%. So the other thing is, in a strange way, the pricing on our loans hasn't changed that much. For a good chunk of the period of the life of the fund, that was, during COVID where base interest rates were zero. So there's a few years there where we probably did 9.5%. So, as a margin, we were getting 900 over.
Yeah, RBA cash rate plus 9 is huge.
And the cash rate now is 4.3, maybe going down, who knows. And we've done 14.6%, so the margin is not that wildly different, but the starting point for the base rate is substantially
different. Glad you brought up the historical as well. What's changed in the past 5 years? Because the five-year average has been, 10% and a bit, and now we've done 14 for this year. So what's really changed?
Look, we had some opportunities that came to us, some of the upfronts and a few things sort of drove that. So the base in like, the base portfolio is probably producing you at a top line rate about 13%. So it's been topped up a bit from that. It's sort of been trending that way. But like I said, since inception, our return's 10.4%. So we're not in the business of forecasting out, but, the portfolio should, the in-place deals that we're seeing at the moment for senior loans at around that sort of 12 to 14% mark. That's what we're seeing. If they start to reduce interest rates, would that come down a bit? Yeah, probably. It's not perfectly linear that you click your fingers. Our book is about 57% floating, 43% fixed rates. So it's not like they will reprice automatically. We tend to follow with a little bit of a lag where base rates go. For example, my colleague who runs our enhanced fund, his stuff is all floating rate, so that reprices at the end of each month if there's an interest rate change.
No, because that's what I was wondering, because you mentioned some of the loans you're like doing, 18 months to 2 years?
Yeah.
So I was wondering if there was a lag on lower rates from historical stuff.
A little bit of a lag.
That's just starting to work its way out. But then, as you mentioned, you got fixed and floating as well.
That's fixed and floating.
So I was just trying to work out, where it...
Yeah, there's a few components. And the other thing is, by our nature, and I suppose the benefit away of lending relatively short, is the average remaining life of the portfolio of our in-place loans is about 0.84 of a year. So we've always got money coming back. So over the course of 2024, about 60% of the book got repaid and reinvested. So one of the things for us is to try and line up new deals so we don't have drag. And whenever you're reinvesting, effectively you're sort of retouching the market as to what market conditions are for pricing. So, we've got a little bit more cash than we would ordinarily like. We like to run the book at about 5 to 7% cash portfolio. It's probably around the 10% mark We've got a few things that'll be repaying in the first quarter. So for us,
so you're sitting about 55 million cash, you know, looking for a home currently.
Yeah, well, a little bit of that builds up. We obviously pay distributions and the like. It's probably an important thing to just touch on in terms of the nature of the fund. So for our investors, we accept applications on a monthly basis. We pay distributions and redemptions on a quarterly basis. So that's one of the other advantages of lending short is we've got money coming back. So, you know, on average, like I said, the book has about 0.84 of a year to run. So if we were to, God forbid, if we were to stop everything today, those loans would repay over the sort of course of a year or so, a bit less than a year, and we could return that money to investors.
Whilst we're on this point, I was chatting to a colleague before regarding one of the issues a lot of advisors are having with platforms. So platforms, if people aren't familiar with it, is essentially like your login portal, which gives you access to all these funds, which is fantastic because it's just one place. But the main benefit of some of these platforms is they essentially, you guys see just the platform name coming through, not the client. So what's great about that is say you've got $1 million minimum, right, hypothetically. What's the minimum for this one?
Minimum, look, we have a minimum of about $50,000 and then you can tick the box for reinvestment or top up. So the top up component can be less than that.
So the reinvestment is essentially what we're discussing, which is a problem on platforms. So if anyone's listening on a platform right now, we'd love to fix this across the board, Because essentially, if just to play it out, what's happening is as follows, is we're getting beautiful returns from, you know, your fund or others, right? And then what's happening is that income is being paid into our accounts, potentially a delay anywhere from 2 weeks up until like 45 days or longer, right? Or maybe longer if it's quarterly. Right, you know, up to 90 days or 120, and then we're losing potentially like a number of weeks of the income. Then we receive the cash. Then we have to reallocate. Then we have to wait for the window to go back in. I just don't understand why it's so difficult for these platforms to potentially create, as we're discussing with Tim, another dealer code for the fund. It's just like, you know, with CBA, so we can just decide, hey, we want DVP, DRP, dividend reinvestment plan. Why the hell can't we just do that and then tick the box and then we can get compound interest instead of receiving the cash all the time? It's driving me up the goddamn wall.
So to be clear, you can tick the box for DRP with the fund. But you're right. It does.
Obviously, if you go direct. But what's happening is with
the platforms, it is clunky. Effectively, we pay the money out and then it gets reallocated or whatever. And as you say, depending on the fund and depending on the time frame, there's a sort of lag there that you get that cash back. And if you might want to put it back to work, it takes a little while. Greater minds than I will have to solve that in terms of how the platforms adjust to that or can control that.
Is there
that.
Any thought process about how to fix that?
We've had some thoughts, yes, and we've.
What is the thoughts? I'm generally interested, right? Because there's a lot of people. Because remember, a lot of people that listen to this, some people go direct, right? Absolutely, right. Yep. But the problem with going direct, you have to deal with the paperwork, and God forbid if there's a crash, whatever it is, we send it before with the GFC, scrambling to get 20 different funds out and paperwork is a massive headache. So the platforms are phenomenal for ease of use and access. They're amazing. Yep. They're great. But I've just identified one little area we need to fix. And I would love to hear your thoughts. And then I'm the one that's going to go, knock, knock, hey, mate, how do we – because essentially what I'm noticing is essentially they listen to advisors and the clients and the money component to make a fix instead of the product. Like, so I'm just trying to – yeah, what's the solution?
You're going to be greater minds than I – no, look, it really comes down to the individual client's liquidity profile, I think, because there must be some mechanics. I know Tim, my colleagues have met with them in terms of, as you say, tick the box for like a different class that – you know, different class of unit that then merges into the ordinary units, but there must be a way. But it does seem to be very difficult that effectively the cash has to be paid out and then reinvested as opposed to just retained. But I'm not an expert in how the platforms work.
It's driving me up the wall. I'm not so with your payout terms with the platform. How many days are we actually losing, you reckon?
So we pay quarterly. So distributions for the last quarter that finished, being the end of the year at 31 December, we paid that distribution in about the 19th of January. So there's a little bit of lag. We have to, agree all the numbers. So it's usually about anywhere between sort of 14 to 21 days after that. Now, you can then reinvest that with us because we're a monthly.
I know, but I want everyone to come through me, obviously. I'm just joking. I'm being completely cheeky here. But the reason why we're having these conversations, everyone's like, mate, it's your business. Why are you discussing this? Why would you do this? Because at the end of the day, the whole point of this is to shine transparency and solve problems to make things more efficient and better for the investors and overall and make it easier.
Customer.
Correct. Yeah. It's in their best interest across the board. But I'm just trying to ascertain: is it just too hard for these funds, or is it too difficult? Or
I think it's too difficult because effectively, well, depends on the underlying investor. So they may want that income to live off or make other investments or do other things with. So I think there's a component there between the relationship between the advisor and the underlying investor.
But it
does seem to be pretty difficult.
Some bad math, right? That's 21 days, four times a year.
Yeah.
So it's 21 days, four times a year, right? And if it's paying 12%, come on, you're doing better than the math component. I'm good at the strategy, Toby. So what's that?
Yeah,
that's 84 days. 84 days.
Maybe a 360 or what?
Over 12%.
You're probably thinking 1.5% or something, probably a bit more.
Wait on a second. No, we're looking at about 2.4-2.5% loss.
It won't be exactly that much. I think it won't be perfectly linear, but yeah, you're probably less than 1.5%, maybe 2%.
Jesus Christ. We're still with the money that we're in, so sticking $1 million, we're still receiving that amount of money. But I'm just saying, like, compound interest, lag. I'll solve this problem. Don't you worry, everyone out there. Any advisors out there, come on, let's get a class action to get this crew and get and fix this problem. All for it.
When you do solve it, let us know.
Yeah. I think every fund manager will be very, very happy about it. Very, very interesting. With the mechanics, is there anything else we haven't covered?
No, look, the only thing that probably my internal legal always remind me of is our underlying loans are illiquid. So, we don't own ASX listed shares that I could sell, at the drop of a hat. So, in the extreme, if there was COVID style or GFC, we've not had to do this. But if everybody, not unlike the Commonwealth Bank, if everybody wanted to get their money out on the same day, we would have to wait for the loans to mature and repay it. Like I said, we haven't had to have that difficulty and confront that as yet, hence the reason we always have a bit of cash, a bit of liquidity in the portfolio.
Makes a lot of sense. So let's get into the fun stuff, the macroeconomics. My God, the regime change. I listen to it again way too much Rogan, as everyone knows. And he keeps referring to like the days of our lives. It's like, what's new? What's the latest episode on This Is Our World? Oh my God, it's been a gripping TV show.
It has been a great, the returning president has been there for less than a month, I think, since he's been sworn in, and there's been a lot going on. So, we're not macro forecasters.
No, I know, but I suppose where I was going along those lines is, two things is, what's your thoughts? And then secondly, how do these potentially changes impact you guys? Because, as the expression goes, US sneezes, we catch a cold.
So starting with the US, I'm very prepared to say I don't know what's going to happen and from one day to the next. But, clearly, there's been the imposition of tariffs. There seems to be some big, big tax cut program coming. The best thing I heard somebody say about Donald Trump in terms of politically is you should listen to him. Don't take him literally, but take him seriously. So, whether it exactly plays out what he wants to do, But that's, you know, his intent is clearly to get things like manufacturing back to the US as much as possible. Now, whether he's successful on that in the long term, who knows? But, you know, his focus is, ironically, even though there's tariffs that are going to affect everybody, it's very much domestically focused. He's trying to look after the people who supported him and voted him in. So that will be a bit of a wild ride and will probably impact some things like commodities and, you know, drill baby drill, you know, what happens to the oil price and gas and those sort of things. But I think that will play out. You know, we don't sort of muck around in commodities or mining or anything like that in terms of our lending. Domestically, the economy is patchy. What's the old song line? The rich are getting richer, the poor get the picture. You know, it's tough for young people to get into the housing market. It appears that there'll be some sort of interest rate cut this month that appears to be where the market is predicting things. You know, I have different views on that from different colleagues, but that appears where it's heading. The interesting thing has been was the rate of change and the nature of from when we went from 0 to 4.3% over, you know, a fairly compressed period. The Australian economy, ironically, has sort of handled that pretty well. But it is patchy and it's soft, and then there's other components like energy costs and general inflation that has been difficult for businesses and in particular small businesses. So, you know, we're cautious on things. For us, we have a reasonable amount of property exposure. You know, if we're lending, you know, a lot of our stuff is against land in the suburbs of northwest of Sydney, southwest of Sydney. A bit in Melbourne in the west and in the north. We've been refinanced on a couple of things down there recently. Those markets, there's continued drivers and demands in terms of household formation and population growth. So that sort of helps underpin you. And we really don't, you know, we need our borrowers to either sell the projects or deliver the projects. And they need to be able to do that at current prices. So if the price for the underlying house or land goes up, that's great. They make more profit. That's great. But you know, we're after getting our investment return. We don't necessarily need that price to go up. So, you know, we're cautious on things. I think it's patchy. Anybody in business or has got sort of more exposure to underlying consumer demand, that's been relatively tough, and you'd think that might stay subdued for a little while. Then you've got the other complexity of, for whatever reason, we have an election in May, and that people usually sit on their hands a bit coming into that because to see what's going to come out the other side in terms of policy. So that's a bit of a dampener in terms of activity. So we're cautious about things. I've been droning on to my investors for quite some time about this, but you know, over probably the course of the last 2 years, we have pivoted our book slightly. So if you go back to sort of 2020, 2021, we probably had in subordinated positions, so second ranking mezzanine loans, were about 25 or 30% of our portfolio. We thought it was a right way around trade in terms of asset values are increasing, we were getting a premium, and we liked where that position was in terms of the capital structure. We have 1% of our portfolio in subordinated positions at the moment. We have reinvested that money out of subordinated as it's been repaid into senior loans. We want to be first ranking mortgages so that if something goes wrong, you can enforce, sell the asset or rework the asset or recapitalize it. So we think risk reward within our portfolio, even though we've been doing quite a nice return, like I said, a typical loan at the moment, you can get anywhere on a first ranking mortgage 12 to 14% return. We think that's a better return risk reward than getting, say, 15 or 17% in a mezzanine position, just where the market is. We would rather have that first ranking position. So that's how we're finding things. Things will come out of things like the election. There'll be stimulus and expenditure and the like, whether that's for good or for ill. So there's a few forces at play where people are sort of taking a little bit of wait and see approach. The flip side is we also see it when we like it when our borrowers, we have a lot of repeat customers or people that we've lent to in the past. We always like it when, you know, people we know need money or are looking to undertake things and we can deploy it relatively quickly. We don't answer into an investment committee in Hong Kong or somewhere where we, you know, all my independent investment committee members live within 10 minutes of the office. So if we have to have a chat on something quickly, we can all get together. So we've got some flexibility to be able to deploy things and deploy funds relatively quickly.
Yeah, that's good to know. The other thing I love chatting to lenders, especially in the property space, about is you guys see where all the loans are coming from and essentially what, you know, Donruss rejects and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very interested to hear what you're hearing on the street regarding, you know, I suppose what was once great that's essentially becoming a weak area. And then secondly, essentially, where's the boom? Because if you're looking at the city market, it kind of feels like a lot of the profits, unless the specific areas are starting to become more difficult. Meanwhile, the boom up in Queensland is just ripping. So I'm just curious on what you're seeing.
That's probably not a bad summation, right? So Sydney is expensive. The land is expensive. Construction costs over the last 2 or 3 years have gone up. Not that we do that much construction, but they've gone up significantly. So the impact of that is it's harder for developers to stack a site up because they bought the land at a certain price. The construction is a big component of it's gone up. That impacts your land value or you need growth in the underlying, you know, apartment price or whatever to be able to make a profit. You've seen them pivot to things like townhouses, which are less construction intensive. That's sort of like why we like the land. Over the years, we've done quite a bit in Queensland. We haven't got much exposure there at the moment because it's been booming and growing, but it's also coming into some of the same things where construction costs are basically the same in Queensland. So if you've got same construction costs in Brisbane versus Sydney, and prices there are 30% below the Sydney market, you either need a much lower land value or you also can't stack up developments. Then you've got the other added overlay there of the Olympics are coming. So, you know, there's a ramp up in sort of infrastructure spending. They have a big program of hospital refurbishment. So you got sort of forces on labour supply there, which in turn are making things more expensive. So it's a harder market to sort of for us to get in and get into. The good thing, you know, in terms of sourcing our deals, like I said, you know, we have our own networks. There's brokers that bring you deals. We put on an origination, some colleagues of mine who we've done a lot of deals with over the years. They had their own business that they've effectively folded in with us. So they are an origination function for us. So, you know, they're doing a great job. And then, you know, we get repeat customers who have we funded in the past, or we can roll from one project to the next with them. So there's a good pipeline of things. You've just got to, you know, work your way through it. And for us, you know, reinvesting money from expiring loans is obviously important, because not dissimilar to your discussion on the platforms and the DRP. You know, we want to be able to recycle our money from one project into the next and have as little lag and drag on the performance as possible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's just interesting, this entire space. And the other question I have for you as well is, how does the private credit or the private lending space in Australia compare to international? Because this topic actually comes up quite a bit, and specifically, you take like listed managers and people that aren't familiar with it. They're looking at this thing going that when you boil it down to brass tacks, from my understanding, please correct me wrong, Australia's probably got the best laws and regulation to protect investors in the private credit space in Australia compared to the world. Is that accurate, or what's your opinion?
I think we've got well developed consumer protection, investment management requirements for investors. If you compare it to different markets overseas, in particular the US, their private credit market is larger than ours. They've always probably had a larger capital markets banking component rather than just bank finance. Australia has been very much traditionally a bank market. The funds that we see in terms of private credit in the US, they probably do more lending to private equity businesses. Back to the earlier topic that we touched on in terms of leverage, they often have more leverage within their funds, sometimes substantially more. And some of those funds are exchange traded, so the price may fluctuate on for the underlying investors. So they're probably larger and more diverse, but have more inherent leverage in them. The difference, I suppose, for us is probably we have a more, I'd say this broadly in the Australian market, we have a more property and hard asset focused rather than, there are different strategies in terms of private credit in Australia. Quite a few who invest to lend to private equity sponsored businesses, but there are probably, more, I'd argue, that are probably a bit similar to us. People like Matrix and Qualitas and MaxCap, and that they have a reasonable amount of property within their portfolio.
Yeah, it's an interesting space. Regarding, we have to always cover the risks. What's the biggest risk upcoming that you guys face?
Our biggest risk is always, in a way, time and delivery of things, because our rates are relatively high, right? So our borrowers want to pay us back as quick as possible. And we have, there's always a couple that you're putting some more work into. We have a few people who are going through sale processes. A lot of diligence been done. Looks like it's headed in the right direction, but you're not done until you're done. So that's the component for us is, when you lend relatively short, you're in contact with your borrowers and there's a plan that they are executing their way through. So it's just to make them, make sure that they get that way through and get through their processes. And the other component for some of the property things that we lend to is just if you need a rezoning or if you need some component like that, there's a timetable that you work through, but that is
DA.
That is not within your control.
DA is not in your control. It's up to the council which you're dealing with.
That is a reasonable estimate. When you go into something, that is a reasonable estimate, and everybody, agrees and signs off on it. But like I said, it's not something that you can make happen if you've got a regulatory overlay. So that's a component that you sort of work your way through. You hope you have enough sort of leeway and maybe a little bit of slack in your timetable. And we think councils do a great job. They could maybe do it a little bit quicker. Would be helpful.
Efficiency of a council.
Yeah. No. Well.
My wife's Greek, so try dealing with the Greek embassy trying to get the kids' passports, dual passports. I think the process is still going on 2 or 3 years later.
Well, that would.
It's a little bit more efficient than some other, embassies around the world.
That would be difficult. There's no doubt about that, and probably to come back to one of your earlier points about. The macro environment, one of the amazing things I think that people are probably, whether you like Trump or not, is the Elon Musk-led, sort of Doge stuff in terms of government efficiency, but that might be his biggest export or legacy is people want things like approval authorities and government expenditure to be more efficient and work for them. It shouldn't take you 2 years to get a passport, no matter where it is.
The other thing which I actually love what he's doing is like we run our own businesses, right? So we can kind of do what we want with an extent. You know, essentially we're beholden to our investors, right? And what I love about Elon is as Elon's doing these presentations in the Oval Office, he's got his kid on his shoulders. I love that, right? You know, a lot of families back in the day, thank God for technology, right? You know, we couldn't have that. We both have kids, right? So it's so good to actually be able to be there in the thick of it instead of you leaving at 6, you're back at 7, and it's like you don't really see him that much. So I thought that was so cool that he's starting to bring like the family in. He's just this little kid just running around
and
doing laps. Meanwhile, he's addressing the entire world on like huge topics regarding the Doge. I just was like, wow, that's awesome.
And more accepted by people.
I love how it's more accepted.
In a way, one of the good byproducts of COVID was you had a lot of Zoom meetings and so you got to meet people's dogs or kids or whoever wandered into the room.
Some of the bloopers on major TV stations that happened were amazing.
Yes, yeah. So people got used to it in a way. So it's reflective of the nature of change.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
Don't think so. From our point of view, it probably sounds a bit boring, but we've been running this fund and running our other stuff for sort of 13 or 14 years. So, you know, we're not starting a Bitcoin fund or anything like that. It's business as usual for us, navigating the ups and downs of things. And you know,
you brought up Bitcoin. A guy which I follow, Cardone, I was saying, Greg Cardone, Craig, I can't remember his first name. He just launched the first ever Bitcoin into property fund in the States. Did you see that? Grant Cardone. Have you heard about this?
I haven't heard about that.
No. I thought I'd bring it up as a gig. It was the first one that's ever happened. So he holds, so Bitcoin can come in, is my understanding, right? You can, the cash component's held as Bitcoin, but then he converts it. So it's an internal hedge, internal currency hedge, and then uses the Bitcoin to essentially purchase property inside of a unit trust.
Oh, okay.
Thoughts?
Well, not for me. Not for me as an investor or a manager.
Yeah.
We try and
see. No, I'm not pushing. I'm not saying you guys do it. I was just like, I heard it. I was like, it was the first of its kind. And I was like, fascinating. That's where things are going.
Yeah, it might be one of those things that in 5 years' time we're all doing. But
Bank of Japan's talking about holding XRP and using it as a legal exchange as well. So,
yeah, so there's
all these wild things are starting to happen that are becoming more normalized.
Yeah, they are. Things that not that long ago you would say what central bank would be mucking around, but they're going to invest in digital currency. So but we're just going to.
No, I know, not your space. Keep doing what you're doing. At the end of the day, do what you do and do it well.
Just that's hard enough without trying to understand the vagaries of Bitcoin into property.
Absolutely. Well, Nick, I've really enjoyed this conversation and thank you very much for coming on The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Any use of this recording does not represent the view of any other third party and are the sole personal opinions of the speaker. Any reference to financial products does not constitute advice or recommendation, and before any action, you should seek proper advice from your financial professional. Australian listeners should head to www.moneysmart.gov.au to find more information on obtaining financial advice. To get in touch with York, head to our website, www.yorkwealth.com.au.